Hello, I'm Mark Steiner. Welcome. We are joined this hour. We've been playing this show for quite a while. It didn't before the terrible tragedy that struck Arizona happened. We're here with Ari Berman, who is author of the book Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. He's a contributing writer for The Nation magazine and investigative journalism fellow at the Nation Institute. And has been writing blogs, of course, and been writing as many have, about what's happened and what occurred in Arizona and the responses we heard today from both President Barack Obama and would-be President Sarah Palin.
And let's Ari, hope not.
Ari, welcome. Good to have you in the studio.
Thanks a lot for having me. Nice to be here.
And we encourage you all to join us here, 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888. Bring your thoughts to the airwaves. We're going to play some clips later on the program of the speeches that happened today to reflect a bit on that. And to talk about what that means, we'll be doing it again, of course, on Monday, on Martin Luther King Day. We'll be doing a whole day of reflection on all those things, on violence in our society and poverty in our society. So you want to be part of that conversation then as well. But and again, welcome. Good to have you. Welcome to Baltimore.
Thanks. It's nice to be here ever so briefly. Not on this show, of course, but in the city.
In the city. We'll get you back here and we'll shake around. And you're a fan of The Wire. You say everything before we went on the air.
Absolutely. Love The Wire.
See, it's a good thing. So let's talk about let me just begin with what's been going on and what you've been writing the last few days, and we'll come back to your book and then come back to that a little later in the program again. I just think that the speech that President Barack Obama gave today was an Obama speech.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it reminded me of the speech on race in some ways. It was very powerfully written and spoken.
And the thing about Obama, having followed him for a while, is that you think you know what he's going to say, but you don't really know, and you can't really know until you hear it at times. He has a way of rising to the occasion. And so I had prepared some thoughts before the speech about Obama and Clinton and how Clinton responded to Oklahoma City. And I went back and looked at all these Clinton speeches and put all these Clinton speeches in this long blog post I was planning to write. And then I watched the Obama speech and I had talked to some people that had read it earlier in the day. And I said, oh, man, this is beyond Clinton. I mean, Obama, I think, can go to places that Clinton couldn't go to. I mean, Clinton had other political skills. Mm-hmm. But the range of notes that Obama hit in that speech was remarkable to me. I mean, number one, first just celebrating the people's lives who we lost in an upbeat way that I think the victims needed to hear. I mean, we needed to celebrate these people as people. So it wasn't just this tragedy.
Right.
I think that was really important. And I think it was really nice that he did that at the outset, because then he went to a deeper place and a place where you need his empathy, his poetry, and his thoughtfulness, that combination to get you there. It's not a speech that any president could write or any president could deliver. George W. Bush couldn't have given that speech.
Right.
As Gary Wills said on the New York Review of Books blog today, Abraham Lincoln could have given that speech. Not to put Obama on too high of a pedestal, but I think there are moments where he does rise to that occasion. And I think he just synthesized what so many people were feeling, which is that we needed to grieve, but we also needed, in the wake of the tragedy, with so much being said, we needed to try to appeal to our better angels. And that's always been Obama's appeal. And it's really interesting because a lot of politicians get very far with cheap demagoguery. Mm-hmm. That's really how they get there, the Huey Long way of doing politics. And Obama's appeal has always been different. And it's confounded a lot of people. I mean, I was really surprised. I did not think he could get elected in 2008 talking about hope. I just thought that it wasn't going to move a Democratic primary audience who at that point—
Jones is at such a young age, Ari Berman.
I guess I'm cynical after having covered a few different elections. But he did it, you know, and he's consistently done it. And he's consistently—I think at times he's gone too far perhaps with the civility rhetoric. But I thought last night it was perfectly appropriate.
It was, because I think that in a moment like that, what he did was touch where most Americans are, the majority of Americans are, which is wanting to have a civil society without the madness, which is what hope was about, which is why he won.
Well, and there's been this incredible disconnect between Obama and how he thinks of himself and what he wants to project, the sensible, rational, hopeful person that he wants to be and the leader that he wants to be, and the caricature of him that has been painted by the Republicans, him being this un-American, socialist threat to free enterprise. I don't think you could have found a more strenuous defense of American values than that, those words of Obama last night. I mean, if that wasn't the best of America, then I don't know what was. I mean, it was almost like a Reagan-esque moment for Obama. I mean, it sounded corny in a lot of times when Reagan did it. And I have a piece coming out in The Nation. I look at Reagan and Clinton and the different models of leadership. And so I've been looking at a lot of old Reagan speeches, and it's before my time, of course. But I've been going back and looking at a lot of Reagan speeches. And I mean, it sounded corny, but Reagan stuck with it. He hit, and eventually the country moved to where he was. And I think that's the hope that Obama has too, is, you know, this is his script. He's sticking to it. And at moments like these, it becomes reassuring and inspiring.
So when you see that, and this book that you've written, Herding Donkeys, which we'll kind of work our way through here, I mean, I wonder if this is one of these moments for President Barack Obama and the nation where there's a shift, or if this is just a moment where he gave a powerful speech that touched our hearts because of the moment we're in.
It's really hard to know. There were no policy prescriptions in the speech.
As there should not have been, I think.
No, as there should not have been. But I'm just saying, in terms of where you go from here, I mean, other than we need to treat ourselves better, we need to create the sort of democracy that, as he said, 9-year-old Christina would be proud of. But I mean, there's a lot of impediments to creating that democracy that go beyond just being more civil to each other. Next week, the House is going to vote on whether to repeal health care reform.
Right.
So, I mean, politics ain't going to stop, okay? It's pretty obvious it's not going to stop. What Obama's going to do, how he's going to position himself in years 3 and 4, is still very much unclear. We still don't know. And so I think the speech could in some ways pivot him as a leader who can rise above the pettiness that exists in his mind in both parties. Now, I think Republicans are more guilty of it than Democrats, but there's no doubt that if you looked on Twitter in the last week, there was a whole lot of back and forth that probably, as he said, didn't lift up people in the wake of that trauma. But I do think there's a lot of hard questions about where we go as a society, not just in the wake of Arizona, but just in all these problems, healthcare, the economic crisis, et cetera, that the speech is not going to tell you how Obama's going to solve those problems.
Now, why do you lay that, what you just said, that at the doorstep more of Republicans than Democrats?
Well, listen, the last Democratic president, Barack Obama, came to the White House talking about hope. We just established that.
Right.
The most popular figure in the Republican Party today, or the most known figure in the Republican Party today, of course, is Sarah Palin, who has the exact opposite appeal. I mean, if Obama is hope, Palin in some ways positions himself as the anti-hope. I mean, she is angry. She is anti-hope. She
anti-hope.
Is angry. She is divisive, and she has been ever since she was put on John McCain's ticket. I mean, that has really been her appeal. She was the attack dog from day one. And so, if you look at the Tea Party, I mean, the roots of the Tea Party were talking about fears of the government, fears of Obama as the other, stirring up incredible rage and anger, exploiting a lot of the legitimate confusion that people felt about the economic crisis, and positioning that to paint Obama as a socialist. And so, I mean, I think the Tea Party, like Palin, is motivated in a great sense by anger and bitterness, not towards Obama, but towards a lot of people. And I basically think that that rhetoric now is sort of par for the course in the Republican Party. And I don't think that there's a corresponding chunk of the Democratic Party that is as big or as loud in that direction.
You know, in some ways, like, you didn't talk about it in your book much. I promise we'll get to the heart of your book in a second as we do this. But that you didn't talk much about it in this book, but people have always talked about the connection between Abraham Lincoln and Barack Obama. And we've been spending a lot of time here thinking about the Civil War because we're out in the sesquicentennial and reading a lot of Lincoln and talking a lot of Lincoln and that period. And in many ways, Obama is a lot like Lincoln in that Lincoln was not confrontational. He tried to appeal and appease Southern racist slave owners as well as abolitionists and people in the North. He tread that line very carefully. When it came to the moment where he thought we had to fight a war, he pushed it, and the war happened. And he was pushed into many ways the Emancipation Proclamation, but he was able to go those places and change as he went. And so in many ways, there's a similar temperament there.
Yeah.
Between the two.
Well, and Lincoln had a philosophy of pragmatism, too. I mean, he said if he could have held the Union together without going to war, he would have. It was not his preference, but he had no choice. It was no coincidence that Obama held his campaign kickoff back in 2007 on the steps of the old state capitol in Springfield, Illinois.
Right.
I mean, he reveres Lincoln, and I think his campaign, perhaps too soon, in fact, wanted to position him as the next Lincoln. Those are very big shoes to fill. I think one of the problems Obama's had is we immediately expected him to be like FDR or Lincoln. I mean, that is pretty tough expectations for even the most gifted of leaders. Lincoln was able over time to really own the Civil War in a way that boosted his presidency. I mean, the closest analogy to Obama, I guess you'd have to say, would be the economic crisis. And Obama's had a very hard time relating to the economic crisis. He's not particularly well-versed in economic matters. He doesn't speak about them with the fluency of a Bill Clinton, for example. He's better at displaying empathy on cultural issues, I think. The race speech, the speech he gave about Islam overseas, this last speech. He has a harder time with class for whatever reason, which I think is odd because he grew up in a very working into middle class family.
Right.
And so you think he'd get this as much as everything. He had a mother who passed away early, partly because of inadequate health care. He had a lot of troubles growing up. You know, he's a rare politician who didn't start out with a lot of money. I mean, when his career was starting in Chicago, I mean, they were middle class, and Michelle Obama had a good job, and they were rising into the upper middle class, but they weren't wealthy by any means. And so he gets a lot of these pocketbook issues, but he's had a hard time talking about them, and he's had a hard time reassuring the country that he has a plan to lift us out of this. And that's one reason, I think the overriding reason, why Democrats lost in the last election. I think it remains to be seen in year three whether Obama can regain his footing on the economy.
It does. And I think that when we're just leaving Lincoln here now, but that Lincoln didn't become Lincoln until into the Civil War, Lincoln that we talk about.
Well, and that's another problem is that the instant analysis of Obama is, as we saw, I mean, year two ended. We didn't know. Then something like this happens, and now he gives a speech. And again, the instant analysis says, okay, and his presidency is once again transformed. I mean, so it's hard in the moment to take a long view of it, but I do think we have to try our best to put it in some perspective.
Folks, you can join us here. We're with Ari Berman, 410-319-8888. Ari Berman's latest book.
First book.
Obviously, you said that's why I did a double take. It's your first book. As well, it should be. It's fine. I've got many more books coming out of you in the future. Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. We're talking about President Barack Obama, where we're going the country as a country, where the Democratic Party might be going, why it is where it is now, how Arizona plays into the future dialogue in this country and how it might have also affected his presidency and how it affected you. How do those two speeches affect you today when you heard President Barack Obama's half-an-hour conversation with the mourners at the memorial service in Arizona, and what you thought about the 7.5-minute speech that Sarah Palin gave in front of a fireplace and an American flag. 410-319-8888 as we talk here on the Mark Steiner Show with Ari Berman. You were smiling as we were talking about Sarah Palin and the American flag in the fireplace.
Well, you just can't help but do anything but that. Sarah Palin made a mistake in trying to go toe-to-toe with Barack Obama on the day of his speech. I mean, it showed, I think, once again, that she wasn't ready. She's not ready for primetime, even though she is already in primetime. I mean, she wasn't ready for primetime when McCain put her on the ticket, and she's not ready for primetime now. She's done the exact opposite of what people urged her to after the 08 election, which is go hit the books for a while and come back when you can tell us something of substance. She did the complete opposite. And to her credit, has just gotten bigger and bigger and bigger and richer and richer and richer. But I think the contrast between her and Obama couldn't have been more striking. And she seemed in that videotape with the American flag in the fireplace to look small and petty even then. And after Obama's speech, she looked even more, even smaller and pettier because she made it about her.
Right.
I mean, it's unbelievable to me that Sarah Palin looks at this and she says, what are people saying about me? And Barack Obama pretty clearly knew it wasn't about him. Tucson was not about him. He was there to provide leadership, to help people grieve, to help the nation move on. He wasn't there to talk about how his feelings were hurt. Can you imagine the things that have been said about Barack Obama? I bet you, if you went back and looked at it, the things that were said about Sarah Palin last week were twice as bad they have been said about Barack Obama. No one has said Sarah Palin is not an American citizen.
Right.
I mean, the things that have been said about right. Barack Obama are astonishingly bad. And he doesn't take them personally. I mean, he knows that it comes with the territory. And so I was talking to Paul Begala yesterday, and I mentioned the former Clinton, and I mentioned the Palin thing, and I said, what's she doing here? And he said, well, she might still be running for president, but she's not doing it in a very strategic way, to say the least.
This is true. So talk about where you think – how you think this Democratic Party got to the place it's in. You spend a lot of time in this book talking about the former chairman of the Democratic Party and what he did. I mean, there's a real substantive part of this book is about him. Howard Dean. And what he did to build the Democratic Party. It's almost like a bridge you build between Dean, Howard Dean, and this youthful outburst around him and the eventual hope campaign of Barack Obama.
Well, I really thought that was the untold story of the Obama election, was the bridge between and the evolution of politics from Dean to Obama. I thought it was a really captivating story. I had followed it in terms of magazine pieces for The Nation, but no one had really told the broader story. And I thought, well, okay, there's a lot of books out there, but this way I could offer a unique book, a unique perspective. I was fascinated by the ability of Democrats to regain the Congress and then to win the White House in 2006 and 2008, sort of out of nowhere, quite frankly, especially in 2006, and the reaction to the party in the Bush years. And then I was fascinated by the Obama movement writ large and how that propelled him to the White House, this incredible explosion of grassroots energy. And I wanted to chart how that evolved over time. And it seemed to me that if you look at how Obama was able to achieve what he achieved, it really started with Howard Dean and first Dean's presidential campaign in 2003, which shocked a lot of people, really shook up the Democratic Party. I mean, to give some quick context. I mean, back as you remember, you know, in the 2001-2002 days after 9/11, Democrats were really knocked off balance politically. I would argue that throughout the 90s, the party had become increasingly soulless, increasingly reliant on big money, on corporate donors. The distinctions between the party were becoming smaller and smaller. That explained the appeal of Ralph Nader, for example, and the difficulty Al Gore had in the 2000 election in distinguishing himself from George W. Bush. And that had just gotten worse after 9/11, which Democrats supporting the war in Iraq and the Bush tax cuts and all these other things. And Democrats, rank-and-file Democrats, were looking for a leader who was just going to say, enough, enough. Right. What are we doing here? Let's think twice before we go invade this country that didn't attack us. And it just happened that Howard Dean, the five-term governor of Vermont, who no one really knew about, who was considered a pretty thoughtful, moderate guy when he was governor of that state, came out and he gave that message. He said, enough is enough. And he gave it in a very famous confrontational speech at a Democratic Party meeting in 2003. And that speech went viral before we even really had internet video. It went viral. Right. People heard about it. He was smart enough at the time, at least, to hire this mad genius campaign manager, Joe Trippi, who now lives on the Eastern Shore, and who had spent a lot of years in Silicon Valley in the 1990s thinking about how to use the internet and other emerging social media to try to democratize politics. And just so happened that the Dean message and the Trippi message was a perfect fit for the time. And Dean was cool with because he had no other choice, because John Kerry and John Edwards and Joe Lieberman and Dick Gephardt had all the establishment support. Dean was cool with doing bottom-up grassroots politics, and it just so happened that he had the message, number one, to inspire people, like a Gene McCarthy, like a Bobby Kennedy did.
Right.
And he had a platform that didn't exist before in terms of the internet to start organizing people, to start funding his campaign through small donations, to start letting people in all these different states find each other and organize the campaign in an autonomous way. And even though eventually Dean didn't make it, he had a lot of problems in his campaign. He was a front runner too soon. The country and the party may not have been ready for him as their presidential candidate, but it was this incredibly influential political playbook that he stumbled onto. And even after Iowa, I remember thinking to myself, I mean, this guy is on to something. I mean, this playbook that he has could become the playbook for 21st century American politics.
Did you write about that back then?
I mean, I was studying it back then. It was interesting. I mean, I was just finishing college when Dean was flaming out, but I had it's funny enough, I was taking a class on political communications with a fellow named David Axelrod at Northwestern.
Who
at that time was really more known as Edwards, working for John Edwards, right, than Barack Obama. But as part of the campaign, we had to observe a political campaign and write about it. And so I observed the Howard Dean campaign just as it was falling apart in Iowa. And so I saw it up close. And that was a really interesting experience to me. And then what also happened is through that class, I noticed that out of the 25 kids in the class, about 18 of them volunteered for Barack Obama when he was a distant third running for the U.S. Senate. And I said, okay, very early on, you know, in the winter of 2003, I said to myself, you know, there is something about this Obama guy that people gravitate to. I was perplexed by it when I saw it up close. And then I think a lot of Americans later were perplexed by it. They understood why when he gave that speech at the 2004 Democratic Convention. But I think I was always interested in Dean, and I was very early on keyed into the roots of Obama. And I think the combination of those two made me want to write the book.
It's interesting that as you write about in your book, that they, even though Dean wanted to leave as chairman of the DNC, how he was pushed out. And I always shocked by the enmity between those two camps of men, because I expected a natural affinity.
Yeah.
It didn't occur.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, to give a little bit more backstory, so after Dean, of course, after his presidential campaign flames out, he comes back again out of nowhere to run for chair of the Democratic Party.
And wins.
And everyone says he's crazy. I mean, everyone close to him says, don't run for chair of the party. It's, you know, 447 people vote on the election. It's the most insular group there is. A bunch of insiders who hate you, essentially. Dean realized that even a lot of the insiders were unhappy with how the party was being run. And the rank-and-file Democrats totally didn't think they were being represented. And what he realized is that people in red states and people in blue states alike didn't believe the party was there for them. For different reasons, perhaps, different ideological reasons. But what was happening is that the parties were focusing in Democratic Party in 2000 and 2004 was focusing on the smaller and smaller and smaller group of swing states. And so the election came down to Florida in 2000 and came down to Ohio in 2004. And Dean knew from running for president there was Democrats in all these different places, Democrats in Idaho, for example, that you wouldn't think about. And he had a meeting with all these state chairs at the 2004 Democratic Convention, and they were from red states and blue states. And they said to him, you know, listen, we're being totally ignored by the national party. And Dean thought to himself, well, if we're going to regain the White House and if we're going to become a majority party again, we got to figure out how to expand our reach. Or else we're just going to be in this self-fulfilling prophecy of focusing on a smaller and smaller and smaller group of states. So that's where he came up with what he called this 50-state strategy. And the idea was that you were going to give some basic resources and staff and money to state parties in all 50 states. And through that, you could start electing Democrats in places across the country, you know, not just in blue states like Maryland, but in red states like Alaska. And amazingly enough, it sounds very simple. It was very controversial inside the Democratic Party. People thought he was just throwing money away. But I think if you look at what happened in the 2006 and the 2008 elections, it had a lot of success. But Dean also made a lot of enemies. I mean, he wanted to decentralize power away from Washington. He antagonized a lot of people over the course of doing that because he wanted to, you know, when you decentralize power away from something, you're taking power away from something else. And he was trying to take power away from Washington. People didn't like that. One of the main people who didn't like it was Rahm Emanuel, who at that time was running the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, of course, congressman from Chicago, who became Obama's chief of staff. And Rahm made it very clear to the Obama people that he didn't want Dean around. And because he was the chief of staff and later became, I think, one of the most powerful chiefs of staff in a long time, probably since, I'd probably say since James Baker for Reagan. I mean, because Rahm was so powerful, he was able to push Dean aside, even though there were and there should have been a lot of natural affinity between Dean and the Obama world.
Folks, you can join us here at 410-319-8888. I'm curious your thoughts about after the tragedies in Arizona, where we are going as a nation, what's going to happen to the Democratic Party that's lost so badly. Is it can be rejuvenated? We're talking about it in terms of the book that has been written by Ari Berman called Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. 410-319-8888. We'll take your calls in just a minute. We'll take a very brief break and come right back. I want to remind you on the way to our break that the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late and Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community to prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com, or you can just go to steinershow.org and click on their banner. And now you can click on your phones at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Ari Berman, who has written the book Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. He is a contributing writer to Nation Magazine and investigative journalism fellow at the Nation Institute, 410-319-8888. So I'm curious, that a couple of things popped in my head as I was thinking about what you wrote in the book, and especially the epilogue to your book, where you focused on Texas.
Yeah.
Which I found really interesting. And it was emblematic of two things. It was emblematic of the energy that pushed Barack Obama over the top, and emblematic of the frustration of the moment and the split between the two worlds inside the Democratic Party.
Well, I wanted to end the book after a lot of the book takes place in these formerly red states that were able to go blue in 2006 and 2008 somewhat unexpectedly. So Indiana, North Carolina, Colorado, and then the narrative jumps around to a lot of different places. A lot of those places have now reverted back red, but nonetheless, I wanted to focus at the end of a place that had still yet to turn, that was turning. And the obvious place to me was Texas, because if you look at the demographics of the place, it's changing pretty rapidly, not just with a lot more Hispanics entering the electorate, but a lot of younger college graduates, well-educated people. And it really is starting to look somewhat like the Rainbow Coalition that elected Obama. But there's a lot of impediments, too. I mean, organizing the Democratic Party has not been a priority down there at all.
Herding donkeys.
Yeah. I mean, if there's anywhere that's been difficult to herd donkeys, I'd say Texas is chief among them. And so I spent a lot of time, I mean, first looking, at the efforts of Democrats in Dallas to actually turn that city blue, how it's changing. I mean, I think a lot of people don't even realize that this stuff is occurring, that Houston, Texas, for example, just elected the first lesbian mayor in the country, big city lesbian mayor. And so, I mean, things are changing. There's also a lot of obstacles. One of the things that was interesting when I was reporting the book back in late 2009, early 2010, was that Democrats thought they might take back the Texas House of Representatives, which hadn't happened in a long time. And they were fairly bullish about the fact they were going to be able to win a statewide office for the first time since 1994. I mean, things that you take for granted in Maryland, I mean, Texans really want. I mean, they want a statewide Democrat elected. It didn't happen in 2010. Democrats got absolutely shellacked in the local races in the legislature. It was a very rough moment. The Tea Party really captured the sentiments of the electorate down there in this election. Nonetheless, I think that one of the things I think political journalists don't do enough of is try to look forward and try to see what are the next trends. And to me, I still think places like Texas are the future. They will change. I think if you look at just the Hispanic vote more broadly in the Southwest, I think the Obama coalition is still the coalition of the future. That doesn't mean that it's necessarily going to go the Democrats' way, but if you look at the people that voted for him, I mean, that is the future of America demographically.
Well, that's something, I mean, one of the things you point out in that part of the book is that Texas was the fourth state to be majority-minority.
Yeah.
California, New Mexico, Texas, and what am I missing? I was looking in your book to find out.
Say this. We'll figure it out. We'll figure it out.
But so let's talk about the future for a moment, and where we think this goes. I was thinking about a show we have to do tomorrow. I have to do this TV thing tomorrow unfortunately, with this guy who's very far on the right, which I don't like doing because it's usually a waste of time. But not that I don't love talking to conservatives, because I do, because they have so much to offer. But I think that, at any rate, what I'm saying is that there's a dying world.
Yeah.
There's a world that's kind of losing power, but it's very powerful because of the noise it can make and because of the corporate money that rides behind it, that is pushing it up a wave at the moment.
Well, that's what was so interesting about the 2010 election, was that not only was it a drastically different electorate than the 2008 electorate, it was almost like the 2010 electorate was a reaction to the 2008 electorate. Like, stop. We don't want you to be the future of our country. And I talked to this very interesting community organizer at Harvard named Marshall Ganz, who's a major character in my book, who's a really fascinating guy.
He's been on the show before.
Yeah, and I asked him about the Tea Party when I did a book event with him in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Ganz said to me, listen, the Tea Party is the last gasp of a dying demographic. But that doesn't mean that gasp can't be a big one. But I think in the end, it's a short-term trend. I mean, the angry, older, primarily white electorate is going away, and it's being replaced by an increasingly tolerant, younger, more diverse electorate. And so I think, you know, the Tea Party had their moment. They were powerful. I think ultimately the other electorate's going to prevail. I think what we saw in Tucson, just to bring it back a little bit, was the reminder of that other electorate, what Obama was speaking to, which is that tolerant, multicultural, rainbow coalition that this country is. It's not going back to where it was before. That's the way the country is. It's only going to become more that way. I think a lot of people have legitimate fears in an economic crisis about what's happening. But I think just appealing to the narrower slice of the electorate, I think, is going to be ultimately a losing strategy. And I think you're going to see that once again probably in 2012.
What do you think we're going to see in 2012?
Well, I think it will be a much more volatile election than 2008, because by all indications, the economy is still going to be struggling. I mean, the best estimates I've seen have unemployment over 8%, the best estimates. No president since FDR has ever run for re-election, let alone been re-elected, when the unemployment rate was over 8%. So if you just look from that metric, Obama's facing an uphill battle. I think that could be a bit overstated, though. I think if the economy is growing and if Obama can project that things are getting better, that could be enough for him. There's key constituencies in a lot of places. If you look at Colorado, if you look at Nevada, if you look at New Mexico, those places out west, if Obama can turn out his voters, I mean, if he can turn out young people, if he can turn out Hispanics, if he can turn out African Americans in a way that he did not, that Democrats did not in 2010, they can still win. And I think they will have a much better shot of winning in 2012. So it's not like the electorate has necessarily abandoned him, but they took a pause in 2010 and his voters kind of sat the game out.
410-319-8888. Tell me let's talk a bit about Marshall Ganz for a moment, because he's in your book a lot. He played a pivotal role in the Obama election, designing the social media war. What was the wrong word? The social media campaign, and organizing young people to pull them into this process in a grassroots fashion that few have ever done.
Well, one of the things that was really interesting about the 2008 election is this obscure idea of community organizing came right into the forefront, and the country got a not always accurate crash course in people like Saul Alinsky, who no one had ever really heard of, became these household names and these nefarious figures on the right, but also these inspirational and somewhat forgotten figures on the left. And I wanted to find someone who had that experience and then came into the Obama world having been through that. And so Marshall Ganz was a guy who at a young age was a rabbi's son in Bakersfield, California, came east to study at Harvard, dropped out to go work for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, registering voters down in Mississippi at a very turbulent time in 1964. There was a whole lot of social unrest. So he saw the civil rights movement up close. He came back to California, went and worked for Cesar Chavez and the farm workers. So he had that whole experience of organizing them, worked to organize Hispanic voters in East LA for Bobby Kennedy. So he was at all these really pivotal moments in history, had seen all that, and then basically dropped out of politics, which he viewed as too corrupt and worthless to really get involved in, that organizing couldn't make a difference anymore in the money-infested world of both parties. And I thought that was interesting, too, because that was something that came up a lot. And he came back into politics through the Dean campaign. And the way he came back was that his students were really inspired by Dean and at Harvard, and they told him about it. And so Ganz went out to New Hampshire and helped organize the Dean campaign in New Hampshire along the lines of the community organizing that he had did for Cesar Chavez and for Bobby Kennedy. And he took the same thing and used it for the Obama campaign. And I think one of the myths of the Obama campaign is that David Plouffe and David Axelrod and these Obama advisors just had this game plan and it was executed brilliantly. It evolved over time, and there was real fights and struggles at the local level on up to shape the Obama campaign. And Ganz started holding these trainings called Camp Obama. And basically, he trained people to be mini versions of Barack. I mean, to tell their story. The story was really important. What motivated you to join the campaign? To teach them how to organize, to take ownership of the campaign and ultimately shape the campaign in their own image. And that happened very early on in the Obama campaign. And it distinguished that sort of citizen empowerment, really distinguished it from the Clinton campaign, which had none of that going on, and really distinguished it, obviously, from the McCain campaign later on. And I think the work of people like Ganz and the stories that I tell in the book of these grassroots organizers, I really think that made the Obama campaign what it was, along with the unique combination of Obama, the person, and the campaign that he was able to run. But Obama and David Plouffe and these guys were smart enough to realize that if they just let some people at the bottom have a little bit more say and a little bit more control, that actually the campaign would be much bigger and better off because of it. And I think that's been a missing ingredient in the Obama White House. That combination of top-down and bottom-up has been missing in the Obama White House. It's been all top-down, and the people at the bottom have been somewhat forgotten. And I think that's something that I talk a lot about in the book. And I think if you just talk about looking forward, I mean, I think that remedy, that formula is going to have to change going forward.
So I'm curious, if from what you're writing in the book and this analysis, that where you are, where Ari Berman is, in terms of your youth, your generation, because you, other people, someone else could have written this book, and the book, as a matter of fact, there have been books like that, written this book, and the book would have been negative and downhill and woe is me and it's lost. But that's not the sense you have from this in your book.
Well, I have mixed emotions about what's occurred, and I think the people that I reported on in the book, and including a lot of the younger activists, also have mixed emotions. I mean, two things seem to have occurred. I mean, one is that a lot of young people that worked so hard for Obama after he was elected thought, okay, we did it. Our work is done. They probably should have paid a little bit more attention to how politics worked in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and realized the work ain't done once you elect the guy. And so I think that's one thing that happened. The other thing that's happened is even some of the people that, that were very idealistic, and I, some of them are still there and went into the White House and went into the administration and tried to affect change, realized that it was really hard to do, that there was all these structural hurdles to creating change in Washington, and that Obama wasn't necessarily always on their side. And that's been the most difficult realization here, that Obama talked in his campaign of this different model of doing politics, that he was going to take all the people in his campaign that he had organized in new and dynamic ways, and they were actually going to be a legislative force in Washington that could check the powers of the legislators and the lobbyists. But what ended up happening instead is that basically Obama relied on a lot of the very people that he defeated in the campaign to run his White House, essentially sided with the very establishment that he pledged to fight, cut a lot of deals to get legislation passed on things like healthcare and other issues, and dropped some other issues that were thought to be too controversial, like immigration reform or cap and trade energy legislation. And essentially, there wasn't really a role for a lot of these people, a lot of these activists that they had envisioned. And I think that's been tough for a lot of people to – that's disappointed a lot of people. That's been tough for them to really come to grips with. So they blamed Rahm Emanuel. They blamed other people. And now they kind of wonder, well, is it something about Obama? I mean, what is he comfortable with? Can he shift as a leader? I mean, can Obama go back to being the Obama that we saw in 2008, the Obama who talked about the grassroots, who talked about citizen politics? And I don't know. I mean, I think if you looked at the Arizona speech, we saw that Obama rhetorically. But we don't know going forward which Obama we're going to see. Will we see the inside the Beltway Obama, mm-hmm. who seemed to shrink a lot in the last 2 years? Or will we see the more expansive Obama going forward, really following his convictions and fighting for them? And we don't know the answer to that yet.
Let's play a little clip of the speech. We can talk about it a bit with you and our listeners at 410-319-8888. Let's take clip one.
You see, when a tragedy like this strikes, it is part of our nature to demand explanations, to try to impose some order on the chaos and make sense out of that which seems senseless. Already, we've seen a national conversation commence, not only about the motivations behind these killings, but about everything from the merits of gun safety laws to the adequacy of our mental health system. And much of this process of debating what might be done to prevent such tragedies in the future is an essential ingredient in our exercise of self-government. But at a time when our discourse has become so sharply polarized, at a time when we are far too eager to lay the blame for all that ails the world at the feet of those who happen to think differently than we do, it's important for us to pause for a moment and make sure that we're talking with each other in a way that heals, not in a way that wounds.
I mean, his words were just amazingly powerful. And that is the Obama that people fell in love with, that inspired people in the election that brought him to the White House. And I'm thinking about that, listening to that. I'm looking at parts of your book and reflect on different parts of your book where you spent some time in South Carolina and the rise of young voters that had never voted before, that just raised the Democratic vote in there, or in North Carolina, where you spent. And I love the piece on Bricka Sweet and her speech to in getting people motivated in North Carolina. I mean, those are the people that pushed the thing over the top. And who were moved by that voice. They're still there.
Yeah. They're still out there. And I think Some of them have been incredibly satisfied by the Obama presidency, and they look at the passage of health care reform, the passage of the stimulus bill, the passage of financial reform. They look at a lot of other bills that we don't even hear about, expansion of national service, for example, student loan reform, a whole host of other bills. And they say, listen, Obama, given the hand he was dealt and given the economic crisis, has been an unbelievably successful president. And I'm sympathetic to that argument. Then there's also people that say, okay, we recognize all that, but this was a unique political moment where he and the Democrats could have put their stamp on legislation and had it been really transformative in the way that FDR did. And just 2 years later, Obama lost it. The Republicans gained control of the House. The Tea Party came in and they were beaten into submission, and they didn't accomplish all the things they wanted to, and they didn't fight as hard as they could have for them. And thus, a lot of activists felt like Obama wasn't really the fighter that they envisioned. And I thought in that clip, though, sort of summarized in a way the paradox of the Obama presidency, which is that he's tried to tamp down the polarization when he ran for president and as president. But the polarization keeps getting worse. And that's something that he's had a hard time dealing with, which he enters a negotiating table with Republicans and thinks, okay, I'm a fundamentally rational guy. If you work with me, we can cut a deal. And he's faced with a very ideological opposition that won't give any ground. And so what's happened sometimes in the past 2 years is one side doesn't give any ground and the other side gives a lot of ground. And thus the solution that occurs is not a very good one. I think that happened on a range of legislation. Now we'll see whether Obama can play that game on his terms. And I think it's going to be interesting to see, because there are real differences between the parties. And I think that just talking about civility alone isn't necessarily going to bridge them.
Let's go to the phones. 410-319-8888, because the next clip kind of maybe touches on some of the things you just talked about even more. And Clay, you're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Steiner and guests.
Welcome.
The comment that I would like to make is that a lot of people are under the illusion that you can just elect someone to go to Congress and just make all of these, you know, wonderful changes that people would like to have made, you know, with health care, with the economy, things of that nature. But it's not that simple when you get to Congress. I mean, you have to, I mean, it's just politics, just like the pretty much the statement that your guest just made, you know, about, you know, the promises and things of that nature that Obama went to, that he set to get elected. You know, it's not all that easy to get to Congress, you know, and, you know, pass all this legislations and bills and things of that nature without playing politics. I mean, you have to coddle, cajole, caress, you know, and convince, you know, these people, even in your party that's against you at times, you know, to, hey, we need to pass this legislation to help the people of this country. You know, you just can't, you know, just because someone has great ideas doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be easy to get things done once they get in office. President Obama, you know, he made a lot of promises and he has done a lot of things, but you got to understand that once you get there up on Capitol Hill, it's politics, and people seem to be under this disillusion that, you know, you can just go to, you know, Capitol Hill and, you know, make all these miraculous changes and things of that nature. It just doesn't happen that way. And that's the comment that
Clay, I think you make some very cogent points. That I think that's the other part of this reality. And Eric Alterman, who will be on the show not too long from now, would agree.
Yeah, well, there's a few different issues in there. I mean, one is just you have to navigate the treacherous politics that are the egos and the personalities and the various interests, as parochial as they are, on Capitol Hill. Then there's the fact that our democracy writ large is in a lot of ways largely rigged. The same forces that are powerful in a Republican era are powerful in a Democratic era. the healthcare lobby doesn't go away just because a Democrat is elected president, for example. And that's one thing that Obama had to navigate. And Obama, I think because – and he said this – he wanted to solve these problems so badly that he felt like he needed to take the path of least resistance to get them solved. So in the healthcare bill, that may mean cutting a deal with the insurance company, saying, okay, we won't import lower drugs from Canada as long as you don't run ads against us. I mean, trying to make those sort of deals. I think those kind of deals made the bill – that I'm just taking using healthcare as one example – made the bill a lot more unpopular in the public eye, that Obama was just compromising too soon with all these industries. But he felt like that is one of the things that had to be done for this legislation to pass. And maybe he was right. I would like him going forward in years 3 and 4 to start talking about some of these more structural issues. The fact that one of the reasons our democracy is under assault is not only because of the lack of civility, but also because of the proliferation of money and influence in Washington, D.C., which has only gotten worse in the wake of the Supreme Court Citizens United ruling. And if you want to start solving some of these huge problems we have, you've got to start dealing with this problem. Look at gun control. I mean, it's not an accident that no Democrats want to talk about gun control because the NRA has so much power. And one of the reasons the NRA has so much power is not just because there's a lot of gun owners out there. It's because they do an incredibly good job of representing gun manufacturers who have gotten rich in the Obama era. I mean, they've gotten rich in a lot of different eras, but they've gotten especially rich in the Obama era with increased gun sales. And so even the gun problem, in a way, has its roots in the lobbying and the amount of money that's being spent in Washington. And that can be lumped in with as just politics, but it's a different sort of politics than just negotiating with members of Congress.
I mean, that, but that's – to me, that's part of the heart of it, is that – I don't think we have time to play the other clip, but if we do, they'll say yes, I do. When he talked about violence and what we have to do to tamp down violence in America, to challenge old assumptions, as he said in his speech, the issue is that there is this divide, and most people in America are not ideological. And there was this huge body of people who voted for Barack Obama. Who some went and voted Republican because they were just angry, and some just stayed home. And I'm not talking about the committee. I'm talking about people who can go either way in these debates.
Yeah.
But it's that the power of the other ideology, the power of the ideology of the old, the ones that bought more guns than ever before since Barack Obama got elected, that made all these millions of the manufacturers talk about. I mean, that's where the battle is.
Yeah,
and the question is, and so I think that's what people are worried about, and that's really where it lives.
Well, if you just look at the next step, Obama said in his inaugural address, which was I think also a very powerful piece of rhetoric, it's not about whether government is too big or too small; it's about whether it works.
Right.
People didn't feel like it was working in 2010, so they voted the party in power out. And we'll see if they think it's working in 2012. I think in Arizona, Obama has some pretty powerful evidence to back up what he's been saying. The shooting in Arizona, I mean, not just the fact that if you look at the suspect and what he did in his clear history of mental health illness, that the healthcare bill, for example, offers a major expansion of access to mental health care. It's not appropriate for him to say that in last night. But he needs to say it going forward to defend the bill. Not only that, but on healthcare again, the fact that Gabby Giffords is alive now and other victims of the shooting are alive now because of access to speedy, good, quality healthcare just underscores the need for every American to have that alternative. That is government that works. And I think that's the key to framing the message in 2011 and 2012 for the president.
All right, Berman, it's good to meet you. Good to have you on this program.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Thanks for being here. Herding Donkeys, the fight to rebuild the Democratic Party and reshape American politics. We'll have Ari on by phone in the future just to be part of our discussions. Good to have you here in the studio.
Thank you.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. It's a simple way to stay connected to the topics and events you care about most. Daily content on arts, culture, food design, style, green living, and much more can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at urbanitebaltimore.com. We're going to take a break, come right back, and we'll be talking to the mayor of Cambridge, the first woman, first African-American to be elected in Cambridge, Maryland, a community that saw the last lynching in the state of Maryland. A unique woman. Stay with us.